This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
All right, everybody, it's here. The March to Spring Training and Opening Day is officially upon us. Hey, I'm Rob Bradford from Baseball Isn't Boring, and we'll have you covered every single day with instant reactions to late-breaking signings, determining which players are, yes, truly in the best shape of their lives, and behind-the-scenes stories from all the excitement and intrigue that spring training brings. Follow Baseball Isn't Boring in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sal Capaccio.
Sal Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
Sal
Capaccio.
On WGR.
Sal Capaccio joining us on the Western Hotline. Jeremy and Joe digging in on Myles Garrett. Before we do that, I'm going to attempt to make everybody feel a little bit better about the Bills not being in the Super Bowl, okay? It's a hard thing to do. But I did see this on not just tickets, but hotels in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Sal, here you go. I want you to, in your mind, I want you to picture a hotel room in New Orleans that might cost $198 a night normally. Okay? Visually.
Okay.
Step into that room visually. $198 hotel room in New Orleans. This week, that's $2,000 a night.
Wow.
Woo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Two-star hotels in the area are nearing $1,000 per night. 4 and 5 stars are at $4,000 per night with 3-night minimums. So, you know, yeah, I was reading a story about how ticket prices are down, and the reason that ticket prices are down is because the hotels are so expensive that people are reluctant to buy tickets. So anyway, or it's just Chiefs fatigue, one of the two. Anyway, there you go. Look at that. Look at the bright side, everybody. We all just saved $10,000.
A lot of money.
Well, it's funny. I was at a card show this weekend, and there were a lot of people there, and, you know, Buffalo sports fans, sports card, and got a lot of people coming up to me. Oh, hey, you know, wish you were in New Orleans. And, you know, one guy, basically, I said, you know, hey, I wish I was in New Orleans. He goes, so do I, but I'll be honest with you. He goes, it'd be a lot more expensive than being here today. He said, holy cow. And he alluded to that. He's like, yeah, it's just crazy some of the prices out there he was looking at.
Yeah. So, Sal, yesterday we got the news that Myles Garrett was asking for a trade. He'd like to be traded from the Browns. This had been something that had been kicked around probably for a month or so. And now we have official word from Garrett himself. I feel like this one for most teams in the NFL is a, yes, we should try to get that guy. The question is, what will it cost? Who's willing to pay it? So when you look at the behaviors of Brandon Bean seeking great players, his words at the press conference talking about wanting to get great players, Sean McDermott referencing, you know, you'd like to have a top 1 to 3 or 1 to 5 guy on each side of the ball. You need a couple of those guys. What do you feel the Bills are doing right now? Getting to work hard on this, making calls?
I guess it would depend on what your definition of getting to work hard is. Making calls, sure. I mean, I wouldn't doubt that. Brandon Bean has always said he's always interested in, you know, finding out and calling and seeing what a price is. And, you know, it doesn't mean he's actively pursuing anything at any time, at a certain time, but he's always, you know, interested in knowing what the market is. You're always looking out there. Let's start with what you said, first of all, to start this, which is what made this wild. And yesterday, this news broke while we were on the Extra Point Show I was hosting, and Josh broke in right at 11 o'clock to say, breaking news from Adam Schefter. And I look, it's not a report from Schefter. The difference here is, Myles Garrett did this himself, right? This is not a, hey, I'm reporting Myles Garrett this. This is Myles Garrett literally putting it out there in his own words, I want to be traded. And I think that in itself kind of loses a little bit of leverage for the Browns, right? Like, hey, this guy doesn't want to play for you anymore, right? But sure enough, the Browns still have him under contract for 2 years. Andrew Berry has stated they're not going to trade him. I don't know how this gets resolved, but if you do start going down that road from the Bills' side, for sure. My guess is, here's my guess. Starting point, two number ones, and then swaps of picks. Maybe a player involved in lieu of a number one and different picks. But I think if you're just talking picks, you're probably talking two number ones and then swaps of picks along the way. Like, you give us a third, we give you a fifth, whatever something like that looks like. Is that too rich? That's a good debate. I'm not sure. Myles Garrett, the new acquiring team, according to SpotTrack, our buddy Mike Giannetti, according to him, the acquiring team would take on close to $20 million in cap space this year. I think that Myles Garrett as a player is worth that. I don't think the Bills have the space to do that right now. They'd have to do some maneuvering, but what are you doing with Von Miller? You got Greg Rousseau's contract at $13 million. Are you going to adjust that? You got Josh. So there's a lot of different mechanics here at play for any team, especially including the Bills.
Yeah. So him being worth it, like, to you, is he what everyone's calling him, like, best pass rusher of his generation, like, at least with him, T.J. Watt? Because, I mean, the numbers definitely show it. The accolades, he's an all-pro almost every year. Like, just feels like there's no... I don't even know what the argument against him as a player is. It just feels like he's almost a perfect defensive end.
I agree with you, Joe. I think he's still really good, got a lot left in the tank. Go look at the history of pass rushers, the best pass rushers in the history of this league. They play longer than almost any other position at a high level. Meaning, like, once receivers get to, like, 32, you see the drop-off, right? 31, 32. Once quarterbacks generally get to... I guess you get quarterbacks a little different because so many guys are unicorns now and they can play. But running backs, we know, like, you just don't play into your mid-30s. That's not the case with pass rushers. Like, really good pass rushers. Even Von Miller was playing really great 2 years ago before his ACL. Go look at Reggie White. Look at Bruce Smith.
Pro Football Focus graded Von well this year as a guy that, like, when he was in there, he was good.
100%, right? And I'm talking about the production of sacks, but you're right, Jeremy. I'm looking at the stats. But if you go just back and look at the stats, even before the era of Pro Football Focus, look at Julius Peppers, look at Reggie White, look at Bruce Smith, look at a lot of these guys. If you put that position translates into numbers late in careers when you're great at it, because you can literally just be a one-trick pony at times. I mean, you could get to a point at where you're 35, just go get the quarterback on third down, and you could still be effective. That's not even Myles Garrett. He's a three-down player still. Myles Garrett's going to be a three-down player for the next few years. He's only going to be, this will be his 30-year-old year in the NFL. And to me, a pass rusher at his caliber, his 30-year-old year is in his prime. So let's go back to what Brandon Bean said. As long as number 17 is our quarterback, we're going to keep taking swings and want to win a Super Bowl. That's what their mission is. To me, you have to at least investigate. I'm not here to tell you got to give everything the Browns want. I don't know. I mean, there's a point that comes, like, you just can't do that, because at some point you need these younger players and draft picks to actually be a part of your team due to all of the salary cap constraints you have. Even last year, every Bills draft pick made the team. Part of that is, guys, because of necessity. Like, you have to have younger players being a part of your, I'll say, cheaper labor pool on your team considering your salary cap. So it's not like, oh my God, do everything. But I absolutely think you have to be involved in finding out and trying to see if you could do something to put this player on your team to get you to a Super Bowl and win a Lombardi.
Do you know yet how good idea that the Bills might have cap space-wise? I saw Pro Football Network have that they have $70 million in restructuring and like cap flexibility. Like, they could cut guys like Von if they wanted to, $70 million. But that would be, if you kicked every dollar down the road that you could, and I doubt that they want to do all of that. But with the cap not going up yet either, Sal, like, it would be a lift, but it does feel like that's not precluding them from making this trade, right? Is that even if Garrett said, I want to sign a deal immediately with whoever I go to, and I don't know if he has to say that. I mean, Schefter said it's more about the winning for him, but even if he said, I want to get paid right away, I still feel like the Bills would be able to do it.
Yeah, so if you take... I asked Brandon Bean where they were. He didn't give a number last week, just so everybody's clear. He didn't give a specific. He did say they're in a better spot, like you alluded to. Yeah, I mean, last year they did a lot of things that helped them for this year. The way he put it basically was, there's not as many levers to pull this year, but that's why they did what they did last year, because they knew they wouldn't have as many levers. But what you point out, Joe, is right. They still have some levers. And, yeah, that would be really kicking the can down the road. So, anyway, to get to your question, according to SpotTrack and Over the Cap, if you put them together, one has the Bills at, like, $5 million over, one has $12 million over. Let's split the difference. Let's say $7 to $10 million over. You can clear that in a few moves. You can do a few things in a few moves. I always remember, though, a few years ago when Brandon Bean said, we're not going to be big spenders, and then he signed Von Miller to right. $20 million a year, $120 million contract.
To me, there's a very...
So, I don't think cap space is a barrier to something like this, especially, again, going back to the new team acquiring him is like $19 million a year. That's a lot, right. But that's not like 30, right? You know what I mean? And it, look, I still look at Greg Rousseau at 13.3. What are they going to do with that? Do they want to, if they want to extend him, is Greg Rousseau even some sort of carrot, right? If you're the Browns, do you say, okay, Bills, you want to do this? Give us your young defensive end who's really good, who's making the same amount of money on your cap, basically.
Yep.
Right? As part of it. I just think about things like that.
The two things there, Sal. Of course, Rousseau would have to sign wherever he goes. But the big thing about the cap for me is last year they had so little cap that they couldn't make a trade like Ayuk because they couldn't afford to bring him in and then restructure. Whereas now, right. Now they'll have the room to do that. So, you know, you might think, well, I mean, Garrett is going to be very expensive, but they just need the room to trade for him day one and then give him $160 yes. million, dollars, and his cap hit this year is $5 million. Like, the flexibility is about, do you have the space to even acquire the guy? And that's what will be different this year than last year.
Good point. And let me just explain how it works mechanically, since you brought it up for everybody. Somebody asked me this on Twitter this morning. How it works. Yes. You can agree to a deal at any time. Now, tomorrow, February 10th, 12th, whatever, right before free agency. You cannot execute the trade officially, as you guys know, and letting everybody know, until the new league year begins on March 12th. At that time, you must have enough cap space to be able to fit him on your top 51. March 12th, 4 p.m. Eastern, that is when top 51 counts. The top 51 salaries on your team must be under that next year's, like, whatever the salary cap is at that time. Which Brandon Bean said, they didn't find out to the combine last year. That could literally be $275 million up from $255 or whatever it was this year. It could be in the 260s. They don't know that. That's part of the trick here, guys. Like, they don't know what the salary cap actually is going to be. So, once you execute that trade, you have to have enough money. Then, when he's on your team, then you can do a restructure, do an extension, something like that. You could also have the trading team go to the player, restructure the contract before he gets traded to his new team.
Yeah.
Well, which could happen. Maybe that's something the Rams actually do with Cooper Kupp. You know, we'll see on something like that. But that's exactly right what you said. And then the other part about this is, yeah, I mean, I don't think by Myles Garrett putting out there that he wants to go to a winner, he wants to be traded, and this is the reason, I don't think he's going to a new team and saying, I need a new deal right away. This reminds me of the Stephon Diggs deal. Do you remember when Stephon got traded and a lot of people thought, oh, he's going to want a new deal? The Bills never did anything with that until the following year.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, okay, he's here. He's going to play for us, and then we're going to revisit that. To me, this would smell a little bit more like a situation like that.
Sal Capaccio on the Western Hotline. Going to be a fun offseason, Sal. I mean, this is a good start, you know? Not bad at all.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. All right. And you know what? I was just looking. The first day of the new league year is actually a little earlier this year because of the way the calendar falls. Mm. It's March 12th. Normally, it's like the 14th or 15th. But that March 10th is the day you can start negotiating. It's not far. I mean, we're at February 4th already. So we're talking, you know, five and a half weeks from now.
Very good. Thank you, Sal.
You got it, guys.
Sal Capaccio on the Western Hotline.
It's time to talk Sabres hockey. Big changes at KeyBank Center. Let's hear all about it. Coach Lindy Ruff is being brought to you by Firth Jewelers. For all the moments in your life, go forth to Firth. By Catholic Health. And by Steve Foley Law. If you've been injured, it's time to get serious. Time to call Steve Foley Law. Now, with head coach Lindy Ruff, here's Jeremy White and Joe DiBiase.
Get the Sabres head coach Lindy Ruff in a moment. Sabres have a four-game win streak. First one in 2 years. Four-game win streak. And just about heading to that Four Nations break. So could be going in on a high note. Their next few games, it's worth mentioning, Joe, if you want to play this game real quick. They're facing a soft part of the schedule. Up next is Nashville. Bad.
Right.
The Rangers, decent, but having a rough year.
Yeah.
Then it's Ducks.
Not good.
not good at all. Hurricanes, forget that one.
They're good.
Montreal, San Jose.
Okay.
Like six out of seven are some, whatever, beatable opponents.
We're talking about teams at the bottom of the standings, bottom of the standings.
Then it goes Tampa, Florida, Edmonton, but whatever. Bottom of the standings after the break. The break, of course, will go from February 8th to 22nd for the Four Nations, and that'll be interesting to watch. I wonder how into that we will get.
Canada, we'll see. Mitch Marner dealing with an injury, and now Crosby got hurt yesterday, too, and they're both, you know, obviously would be on Team Canada if they're healthy, so yeah. We'll see.
Lindy Ruff, Sabres head coach Lindy Ruff, joining us on the Western Hotline. Lindy, good morning. It's Jeremy and Joe. Thanks for taking some time today.
Yeah, morning, gentlemen. How are we doing?
Pretty good. We'll start with the big news, good news, four-game win streak, first one for the team in a couple of years. And I'd imagine a four-game win streak's got to feel pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, the way we've ground through some of these games have been tight games. Last night was a tight game, and, you know, we had some guys out. They had some guys out, but every team deals with adversity, from players being injured to whatever, and really there's nothing but winning a game that makes the difference.
You mentioned on Sunday, Lindy, after the game, that you think the group is getting better at grinding. Did you feel like last night was an example of that in the third period? I mean, the team was on their heels a lot in the third, but whether it was block shots or whatever, like to get it home, I'm sure, is a good feeling, because that has not always been the case this season.
Yeah, you know, I think you look at, you know, we dressed 11 forwards, we lose a forward in the game, we're down to three lines, a third period. You have to be smart. The good teams don't give up high quality chances. They don't take penalties when you've got a couple goal lead. I think if you look at or break down the third period, we gave up with the one opportunity where they kind of went through the seam on the entry and got a, you know, probably what I would say a B scoring chance, which was their only really good chance in the third period. So if you're asking your goalie, you know, only to make one or two saves and don't take any penalties, your odds of winning a hockey game go way up. And I think we failed that test early in the year. I think we're starting to pass the test now.
Sabres head coach Lindy Ruff joining us. Lindy, of course, it's been tumultuous might be a little strong, but the last 48 hours from the Tage hit, you know, your response in post-game, you were a little fired up, players met. Take us through the whole thing, if you can. I mean, after the game, there were a couple of different answers from different players, and then a meeting takes place to address that there would be a response next time. Was that a players' meeting? Was that driven by...
That was a meeting where we were all involved. And I said last night in the press conference, I have had three or four of these hard meetings. They come after where you don't play well, where we may be talking about the compete in the game, the lost battles in the game, the lack of discipline in the game where you take bad penalties. This was just another scenario where, you know, we dealt with this. We talked about it. You go back to the start of the year when I don't even know what game somebody ran, whoever, and instantly Tuck dropped his gloves and fought the guy on what looked like a bad hit. Right response. We went through the scenario and we've moved on.
I wonder, Lindy, how Dahlin has been in recent days. He is one of the guys that post-game said that can't happen again. And he's obviously wearing the C, and he's been someone in the past that's played with fire, and he's stood up for teammates too. So I wonder what you've seen from him, even if it's not specifics, just him being a leader, first year as the captain, kind of how he has acted in a situation in meetings like this in recent days.
Yeah, you know, I think it's probably hardest on your leaders, that type of situation. And what he said is true to the core. You know, it just can't happen. you know, and you can look at all types of scenarios where maybe a player didn't see the play, and referees are yelling accident, it was an accident, you know, anything. There's all kinds of things I've heard through the years when something like that happens. You err on the side that, you know, you've got to love your teammates. You can't judge what anybody else thinks, but you've got to react to that situation, and it can't happen.
Sabres head coach Lindy Ruff, you guys, you know, as you say, you've moved on. So the meeting is not just about how what has happened can't happen again. It's obviously addressing it going forward in the future. And I guess what I would wonder, or what I would ask Lindy, is do you think it's about youth? Do you think it's about the type of team? Is it about telling the guys that maybe think that's not my job that, yes, in fact, that is your job in that spot?
No, I believe everybody knows. Everybody knows. You really should feel sick about the whole situation. This isn't about that's not my job. This is about loving your teammates and pack mentality. And it's not even about it. It's not even about fighting. It's about the core of what a team is. That you're there for your teammate. All five guys are there for your teammate. Sometimes it's all six guys are there for the teammate. And we've seen that in the past where, you know, a goalie gets involved. That's what it's about. It's about, you know, caring for each other in that 2.5 hour, three hour window, where when stuff like that happens, the team comes first.
From last night's game, the opening faceoff, hearing you in post game say like that was not like pre-planned or anything by you or anybody else on the team. Gilbert going out and dropping the gloves right away. How much do you think that impacted the group on the night? Like less so even than just like, hey, show the league type of thing. I wonder how important it was for the guys themselves.
Well, let's start with the previous game. I start Malenstein, Krebs, and Tuck. Mal had a big hit in the Devils game 15 seconds in on Mercer. A lot of times coaches look at who the other team starts. Like who did Buffalo start the previous game? You know, and usually when just the way I am, when we win, I start the same crew. I just kind of reward them for getting us off to a good start. So the plan was to start the same crew, but when I took a look at the lineup, I still had Krebs and Malenstein, but just changed the D. They put their hardest, toughest line out there, and I thought, you know, maybe they were thinking that we're going to come out really aggressive. They're going to counter. Maybe they think they saw what happened last game. They're going to come after us. So that wasn't going to happen.
Two guys I wanted to ask you specifically about, more in a general sense. Power and Samuelson are on the ice on Sunday, but more than that, Lindy, like they've kind of been lightning rods, I would say, for a while. I think it's mostly because of their size. Like they're both big guys. And neither, maybe to different extents, are always looking to be, you know, no one's Scott Stevens anymore, but like super intimidating with their size. Do you think either one of them or in general, players like that need to be more physically aggressive to hit their peak? Or do you think they could be who they are and, you know, still reach success in the league?
Well, I mean, we're talking about, yeah, we're talking about two players that have the same stature. I think we're talking about two players that play a different game. I think both players, to a man, know they needed to get in the previous game. They needed to get in. Owen Power plays a different game than Samuelson. Samuelson's game is he needs to be physical. He needs to end plays. And parts of that game, from the start of the year to him going out of the lineup, that was part of you've got to be more physical. You've got to end plays. His game has elevated, and it has been it has been elevating. He's been, when I go through numbers and I go through ending plays and physicality down low, has been better. It's a process to get him there. If you look at Owen Power, his physicality down low, his game is a different game. His game is more of an offensive game. It's a transporting the puck up the ice type of game. And he's getting better at ending plays with physicality, which he works on every day. It is about, you know, improving in the areas, improving in that physicality area, improving in the areas that will help us make a better team and make him a better player. And it is something that I can tell you that Owen Power works on every practice, after practice. This kid, he'll get better. He'll continue to get better.
Do you feel like on his size, just a follow-up on Power, because he is still only 22, I don't know, for you, like, at that age, do you feel like size-wise, you know, getting more physical, that there's still more growing for him to do just on his physicality, like, just from a body standpoint, more so than even the mindset?
I do. I would liken it, maybe this is a bad example for you, but I would liken it to when I had Tyler Myers, when I started out. It probably took him 3-4 years to the one point. I still remember when he told me after year two, I still don't have my man strength. And a conversation like that just sticks with you. You look at a guy that was 6'7", you expect physicality, you expect, he wasn't strong enough. You know, those first couple of years we worked on trying to get him stronger, eat more, put on a few pounds. And I mean, not put on weight that doesn't help you, but get stronger to where you can end plays, and physically you can be a dominating guy when you need to get. And I think the league has these guys. You go back to, I'll use Wilson that I had here, the big defenseman, where, you know, you try to push these guys into that to help their game. So I can give you a couple of examples of young guys that some guys take longer. I wish it happened quicker. Some guys have it right from the start. Their build, their body has been, their training has been exceptional to that point. And that's where we have to get our guys to.
To Dennis Gilbert on that, you know, you mentioned, Linda, you put out there, you chose who you put out there because you, from what my read of it is, you said that's not going to happen again. You're going to make sure guys are out there. They're not going to get run early in the game. So Gilbert goes out and takes matters into his own hands to send his own message. That's not something, you said it was not organized. So what was your chat with him after the fact?
I had no chat. I had a chat with Gibby pregame. I'll just share that with you. We talked about, you know, what could happen in the game, and then here's these physical players they have. But it wasn't about sending somebody out to fight.
Yeah.
How is you got to follow?
I just want to ask, like, you know, you have that conversation with him, and here you are talking about the physical guys that they may have. And I feel like a Sabre fan that is seeing what happened in the last 24, 48 hours is flashing back to Miller and Lucic and probably asking themselves again, like, do the Sabres have enough players that just have that in them as opposed to being asked to bring it out of them?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. It's something that has to come from within, that when you become a great team, it comes out of you. It comes out of players that, if you look at early in the year when Zucker, who is not a fighter, dropped his gloves and went at somebody, it comes out of you. It is about the group coming together, and it has to come out of you. Some of those guys that, you know, play the role sometimes is only a role because they're carried along because of their teammates.
Lindy Ruff with us on the Western Hotline. Lindy, by the way, how injury-wise, is there an update on Thompson after not playing last night?
Feels good. He's in a day-to-day category. We'll see where he's at today. I can just give you a quick rundown. The UPL, same thing, day-to-day. Probably will not skate today. Sanderson will not skate today. That's probably as deep as I can go with anybody.
Okay.
Kozak has been sick. Kozak and Greenway both will practice with the team, so that's probably the positive news I got for you.
Is that Kozak being sick? We've talked about, how long have we had updates from you on, like, guys getting sick? Has it been a month? Like, is this the same thing that's still kind of running around the team, or is it different?
Exact same thing. Wow. You know, a guy like Kozak has lost 7-8 pounds. He's down 7-8 pounds. And some guys recovered it, like, in 2 to 3 days. We've had a couple guys that it's been 6-7 days, but it's the exact same type of scenario with almost every player. Hmm. So I'm actually trying to stay away from the players.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Although I need the weight loss.
This is the last time we'll speak to you until there's a break. Saturday, the final one before a 2-week stretch. Is that even maybe frustrating to you that the team's starting to get on a roll here, and we'll see what happens Saturday, but then it's 2 weeks off?
I kind of look at it two ways, yeah, a little bit, but at the same time, these guys that are banged up, all the guys we mentioned, it may have come at a good time to get all these guys back. So that, you know, from Kozak to Greenway to Thompson to you name it, getting them all back. So I think you got to weigh where you're at. And by the fact we got one more game before the break, we have to go out and win that.
Will you be watching the Super Bowl?
I will, all right. For sure.
We got a lot of Bills fans.
A lot of Bills fans say they're skipping it.
They say they can't bring themselves to do it.
We'll see.
I can tell you who I'm cheering for.
Is it Philadelphia, I hope?
Yes.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Lindy. Thanks very much, and congratulations on the win streak, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Bye now.
All right.
Thanks, Lindy.
Sabres head coach Lindy Ruff.
All right. Hour number two on a Tuesday. Chris Brown, Steve Tasker with you here on One Bills Live, and pleased to be joined now by ESPN NFL Draft insider and analyst Matt Miller, cranking out the content already. I mean, we're 3 months out, give or take, and he's cranking it out already on ESPN.com and everywhere else on all their live programming. So, Matt, thanks for giving us some time during what is, quote-unquote, your busy season. Saw your recent two-round mock. I want to begin overview-wise here, though, because I want to see if you're in concert with what the prevailing opinions seem to be right now concerning this class overall, and that is, number one, is it a little light on the elite blue-chip talent and heavy on meat and potatoes between, like, say, picks 20 and 80?
Yeah, absolutely, guys. Appreciate you having me on. And I would say maybe even more than that. I think you have a handful, 4 or 5 blue chip players. So that'll kind of be the conversation. And then I feel like you have a second tier of good players, like just solid football players. That might be picks 5 through 15, 6 through 15, somewhere in there. And then I think you get into that area that you're talking about where picks, it might be picks 20 to 60 all have a very, very similar draft grade. So it is a good year to have needs on the defensive line. It's a good year to have needs at tight end, running back. It's not the greatest year for wide receivers, which is, when was the last time we said that, right? That it's not a good wide receiver draft.
Yeah.
It feels like it's been forever. It's not the deepest year at positions like cornerback. But if you need line play, O-line, D-line, defensive end, this is a fantastic year for it.
I know that I don't know if you track this or not, because I know, you know, you've got a 2-round mock draft right now and stuff. But as free agency comes around, and then the draft hits, but free agency really changes things for teams. Plus the post June 1, where you trade guys and all that. But how much is your experience tell you that teams' needs change after the first week or two of free agency, just before the draft? It's got to change it significantly. I know it did with the Bills.
Oh, it absolutely does. And you think you have an idea, you know, in season of what a team's needs would be. So I'd say right now, I have the Bills' top 5 needs: D end, corner, defensive tackle, linebacker, and safety or wide receiver. But, you know, things like retirements are going to impact that. Free agency, Rasul Douglas, Amari Cooper, those signings or not signings will absolutely impact this. And there's always surprise trades, it feels like. You know, we saw, you know, yesterday, Myles Garrett, Cooper Kupp might be on the move. So that definitely shakes things up, additions and subtractions as much as anything. So it is always very, very fluid. I think a big part of our job as draft analysts is to also be studying these NFL teams to say, where are the needs? Where are the weaknesses? Not just 2025, but looking 2026, 2027, because there are some clubs that are going to draft a year or two out on their needs. So it is a big part of the studying that we do is to try to understand where these rosters are at.
I know you covered both the East-West Shrine Bowl and Reese's Senior Bowl here in the last week or so. What are your biggest takeaways from those 2 weeks? Because I know the practice setting is where the real evaluation takes place. Not that the game is dismissed necessarily, but you know what I'm saying. A lot of intel is gathered there in the practice reps where you can get some one-on-one looks at people. Do you come out of those 2 weeks watching that talent and saying, oh, maybe the draft class is better or deeper in this area than maybe some of us anticipated?
Yeah, definitely. I think tight end is one of those spots. And I know, you know, the Bills are pretty set at tight end, but that is an area where there were guys I liked, but then you get to see them in person and you think, wait, I like this player more than I maybe realized on tape. You see them move in person. That has such a big impact. I think on the flip side, I went into both those events, being on the road for about 10 days, wanting someone to pop at quarterback and wanting someone to pop at wide receiver. And I didn't get that feeling. And that's probably a little bit of experience. That was my 15th Senior Bowl. So I've seen some things over the years in Mobile, Alabama. Some we can talk about, some we can't, obviously. But it's one of those years where you say, I wanted a wide receiver to wow me. You know, I wanted to have that Cooper Kupp moment where a guy comes to the Senior Bowl and just blows you away. That wasn't there for me. And so I think now I need to go back and watch more tape. I need to dig in on some of the juniors more who I haven't, you know, needed to study as in-depth yet and try to see, because teams have needs and they're going to use these picks. So we got to find where the good players. Senior Bowl, that was the best O-line, D-line group I've ever seen combined at a Senior Bowl. The tight end group was great as well. The corner class was really good. It was a top-to-bottom loaded Senior Bowl group. It just didn't have those sexy positions at quarterback and wide receiver that we usually go down there to watch those guys and see who the best of the best is.
So you've got this draft class is very, very top heavy and very shallow at the top. Who is that handful of guys? I mean, who are the names that we're going to get to know intimately through this process? Because a lot of fans don't dive into this until, like, you know, this last weekend when the Buffalo Bills get put out of the playoffs. Now they can think about it maybe a little bit. What's this handful of guys? Who are they?
Abdul Carter, the defensive end from Penn State, best player in the draft, bar none. Travis Hunter from Colorado. He may be a wide receiver. He may be a corner. He may be a little of both. So he's up there as well. Mason Graham, the defensive tackle from Michigan, is an elite player in the trenches. He's a three technique. Really, really good there. Then there's a conversation, right? Will Johnson, the corner from Michigan, he was banged up this year. But on tape, he's a blue chip player. Will Campbell, tackle from LSU. On tape, blue chip player, but his arms are a little bit short. He's going to come in under 33-inch arms. Ashton Johnte, running back from Boise State. Awesome football player, but he's a running back. So I think that's where we're looking at. 5 to 6 players at the top of this draft. After that, there is a little bit of a drop-off to the next group of guys.
And then with respect to your mock draft specifically, Matt, you know, your first pick for the Bills at 30, you go Iman Wari, the safety from South Carolina, you know, who is an athletic talent. And I'm a proponent that the Bills on the back end need to get more team speed and they need to be more athletic in general. This guy is a giant, though, for the safety position these days.
I mean,
this guy could have played safety in the 90s at his size. So he looks like a veritable giant at the position. My question to you is, how much of a hybrid role can he play, you know, with respect to, you know, maybe a little bit up closer to the line, maybe as a pseudo hybrid linebacker type in a nickel package?
Yeah, he's Derwin James. So the hybrid ability is there. 6'3", 220 pounds, and he's every bit of that. He is rocked up, but he's fast. This isn't a situation of 6'3", 220, but he can't open his hips and run. He's going to run in the 4.3s or 4.4s. He is one of the freakiest athletes I saw all season long. So he can do a little bit of everything for you. He's comfortable playing up in the box. He's comfortable playing as a deep free safety. He's a matchup guy, and he was a true junior coming out of South Carolina. So he's still young. He's still developing, which is hard to believe. But I'll tell you, I put him to you guys in this mock draft, and I had a scout call me yesterday morning and say, he's never going to make it to Buffalo. And I was like, come on, let's give the Bills need a playmaker on the back end. Let's make this happen for them. But Scouts from other teams do not want the Buffalo Bills to have a rangy playmaking safety who can also take away the run game for quarterbacks, because he is truly a three-down difference maker.
All right, so let me ask you then, what do you think is the highest he could go? And I'm guessing 30 is around the lowest. Bottom of round one is the floor. Where's the ceiling of how quick he could come off the board?
I think the ceiling is 13 with Miami Dolphins. They've got two safeties who are going to be free agents, Holland especially. So we see teams sometimes say, hey, we created a hole. We couldn't sign this impact player. We'll fill it in the NFL draft. So we'll see what happens with where the pass rushers come off the board. I think that's the thing to watch. If we get a board that's wiped out in terms of pass rushers or even three techniques, then I think there's going to be squads that look at Emmanuel and say, hey, this dude's a difference maker in a draft that's a little light on him. This guy's a difference maker. He's bringing production. He's bringing all-star level traits. Those are the types of guys that always go a little bit earlier than we anticipate.
So give us an idea, too, about some of the other position needs you see for Buffalo and who might be available if Umanwari's off the board.
Yeah, I go back to defensive end. This is a really good defensive end class, and that's going to be the key, is where does that board get wiped out? Like, Abdul Carter is going to go early. Jalen Walker from Georgia, going to go early. Michael Williams from Georgia, also probably going to go in the top 15. Then there's a little bit of a gap to guys like Mike Green from Marshall, who just had an amazing Senior Bowl week. Jack Sawyer from Ohio State. Jack Sawyer, you could plug him into your lineup tomorrow, and he could start for 7 years. He's just incredibly solid in every phase of the game. So the defensive end group would be strong at pick number 30. Corner is a little bit dicey. I like Trey Amos, from Ole Miss. Thought he had a good Senior Bowl week. He would be in play there. I think, you know, Zadie Barron's gone. Will Johnson's gone. You might be looking at someone like Az Thomas, another corner from Florida State who had a really good Senior Bowl week. I think they're in that late first, early second round range. As far as linebackers go, Jihad Campbell, who is maybe a third down rusher as well as a off-ball stack linebacker on first and second down, much more of a hybrid player than the Bills traditionally go for at that position. He's in that range. Carson Sweshinger from UCLA, who I love. He's one of my favorite players in the entire draft at linebacker. He would be in range at 30. So those are the big needs I have right now. But I would say, you know, I would say this for Buffalo, Kansas City, Philadelphia, you know, these teams that are perennially in the driver's seat at the best of the best, like, stop taking projects late first round. Just because you're a good team and you have Hall of Fame quarterbacks, you shouldn't take on projects. I look at what teams like the Rams are doing. Draft guys who are ready to come in and contribute, because you're this close to making a Super Bowl, to winning a Super Bowl. I think you got to go with high impact early players instead of, and we got Josh Allen, we can take time to develop these guys. I would be looking at players who were in Power Four conferences, 3+ year starters, and can come in and play right away as rookies.
All right. And we know the defensive tackle class is a good one, to your point. At the same time, I would argue that the younger players up front on the interior for Buffalo are more of the three technique penetrating variety. And I'm thinking of Ed Oliver and Dwayne Carter, who they just drafted last year. So it's more likely they're looking for a space eater and a one tech that, okay, if they can get some push up in the pocket, great. Does that afford the Bills, you think, the opportunity to wait on that position a little bit, similar to the way you kind of suggested here in your mock, you know, with Josh Farmer going 56 overall in round two for them, because they're, you know, the three techs are going to go first because they're more of a playmaking type defensive tackle. So maybe just help me with the strategy here, and can the Bills sit there and wait until round two and get more of a space eater type?
I think you can, whether that be Josh Farmer, Alfred Collins from Texas, Deion Walker from Kentucky. There are space eaters. And I think round one, like you mentioned, Kenneth Grant from Michigan is the one player in round one who is that space eater that I say, you got to at least think about him in the first round if he's there, because he would pair so well with Ed Oliver. I had him going to Kansas City where he would pair well with Chris Jones. But I do think that you know, one technique, zero technique, that defensive tackle group, you're going to be able to find really good value in the second round. Now, there is a drop-off. Like, I don't know that you wait till round three, because then you're looking at guys who have some type of deficiency, right? So round two, it feels like there will be 2 to 3 pretty solid options at that specific position. And then, you know, if you stack the board this way, if you can get, you know, defensive end or safety in round one, then defensive tackle round two, then I think you leave yourself in pretty good shape to fill in some of the other, you know, higher priority needs in rounds 3 through 7.
I know there's a ton of time that's got to go by and a lot of things are going to happen before the draft, but do you anticipate movement at the top of this draft by teams?
Dumb. So that's a great question, Steve. I think Tennessee would love to trade out of number one overall, despite what, you know, front office might say in press conferences. I think they would trade out. The interesting thing about draft classes that are, as you said, shallow at the top, and then we have this, you know, cluster of 40 players that everybody kind of has the same grade on, we traditionally don't see a lot of movement in those drafts because a team's board doesn't get wiped out as fast. So you might have 6 or 7 targets, but, you know, the team down the road has a completely different group of players. So I think traditionally we don't see as much movement. Now, at the top, it could get crazy because it is a weak quarterback class. If you need a starting quarterback, if you're the Giants, the Raiders, whoever that might be, you have to go get one of two because there are two that are going to go early. Outside of that, I don't see blue chip players that we're going to see a lot of movement for. If we do see movement, I think it would be on the back end of round one, similar to what we saw last year where teams are jockeying to get, you know, last year was the receivers. That group was getting, there was a run. So teams were trying to get those receivers. I could see that being the case this year if some of those defensive ends slip into the 20s where teams say, we got to go get one of these guys before they're all gone. And that would create some trade value.
All right, let me spin that defensive end class a different way here with, you know, Myles Garrett asking for a trade from the Browns. Obviously, he's an appropriately labeled generational talent. And I know you're talking about teams in contention should be looking for instant impact. Are there enough instant impact defensive ends in this class to dissuade a team that's close to winning the whole dang thing away from parting with draft capital and other assets to land a Myles Garrett and instead go the way of the draft?
I mean, let's assume for a second it can work under the salary cap, and I don't have the Bills salary cap memorized quite yet. Give me a couple more weeks and I'll get there. If it could work under the cap, I would be all about it because pick number 30, I mean, that is a roll of the dice on if pick number 30 is going to be an impact or not. And you have no way of knowing who's going to be there. Like we just said, the defensive end group could be wiped out by pick 30 because of how good those players are this year and how many needs there are at, I would say, maybe the second most important position in all of football. So yeah, if you can make it work money-wise, I would be all over Myles Garrett. To have the best defensive player in football with, you know, Superman at quarterback, that's a pretty great way to do it on both sides. I know some Bills fans might be a little, you know, jaded by the Von Miller move and maybe feeling like, oh, well, we've tried that before. Myles Garrett's 29 years old. He has been unstoppable. He's actually getting better. If you look at his last three seasons, he's actually become more efficient, more impactful. So if you can find a way to do it, I don't think it's going to be as expensive as the Twitter GMs want you to believe. I don't think you're getting 3 first-round picks for a 29-year-old pass rusher who's going to want a new contract. It's certainly going to be at least 1 first-round pick plus, you know, whether that be an impact player or another pick. But it would certainly be fascinating. And if you know, Brandon Bean calls and asks, I would say do it because that would be an unstoppable duo on offense and defense.
Yeah, so give us an idea of the way you understand it. What's the holdup? I mean, it's certainly got to be the economics on Cleveland's end of it, right?
Yeah, I think so. It just, you know, you also, I think if you're Cleveland, you don't want to admit defeat. You don't want to say we're this far from competing, from contending that our Hall of Fame player wants out. I think that's hard for an ownership group, for a front office to kind of signal, you know, you're raising the white flag and saying, okay, we can't win. We got to let this guy go somewhere else. So, and then economically, you know, for Cleveland, I think the dead cap situation, if they were to trade him, would be catastrophic on top of the fact that they're also trying to deal with the Deshaun Watson contract situation as well. So it's just a case in point of how one bad move can have such a big domino effect for a roster. And it's why it's so important to get those things right when you're handing over $250 million guaranteed.
Matt, thanks for the time. Appreciate it. I'm sure we'll catch up with you down the line here, maybe even out in Indy at the Combine like we did the past couple of years. Look forward
to it.
Thanks,
Matt.
Appreciate you guys. Thanks so much.
All right. That's Matt Miller, ESPN NFL draft analyst and insider. And just so it's clear for everybody, in his 2-round mock, he went Bills in round 1 at 30, South Carolina safety Nick Emenwori. Then round 2, pick 56 with the Minnesota pick that they acquired in the trade for Diggs to Houston. He has the Bills taking Joshua Farmer, the defensive tackle out of Florida State. And then six picks later, their own pick at 62, he has them taking edge rusher Landon Jackson out of Arkansas. He was the LSU transfer that finished his college career there. I think he had 6.5 sacks each of the last two seasons for the Razorbacks.
With hockey insider Darren Dreger from TSN. Drags, it is a very challenging time for a number of teams right now dealing with injuries. Sabres certainly in that group. Some of it kind of the day-to-day nature here as they approach their final game before the break against Nashville on Saturday.
Yeah.
Bigger picture, though, it also seems like certain names on the roster can't escape the rumor mill at this point in time. What are you hearing on the Sabre front?
Oh, hearing everything. Sabres front, to be
are
fair.
Are Duffer and I on the market? Are they trading us too?
Yeah, but the value is low. The return is low.
Your door was wide open and you took it. Thank you.
Bucket of pucks, as we learned last segment.
Yeah,
Marty.
Not a dozen sticks. That's too much money.
No, hey, fellas, like, you know, you deal with it every single day. As do I, and a big part of the challenge of this time of year is separating fact from fiction. And, you know, when I see certain names, I mean, Dylan Cousins has been out there really dating all the way back to the original speculation connecting the Vancouver Canucks and maybe Elias Pettersson, you know, for Byram and Cousins. And that really hasn't faded specific to Dylan. And part of me thinks it's unfair, you know, that the player should have to deal with this on a day in and day out basis. Now, he's probably developed some scar tissue and it's just kind of what the league has become. But look, Kevin Adams is no closer to trading Dylan Cousins today than he might've been back then, but he has to be open to suggestions, to offers, to any sort of scenario that is going to make Buffalo Sabres better today and in the longer term. So I don't think that anything is going to change, but it is interesting to me because now we're starting to link certain clubs. You know, Pierre LeBrun earlier this week talking about the Calgary Flames' interest in Dylan Cousins. And my pushback to Pierre was, okay, but who's coming off of Calgary's roster for Dylan Cousins? Dustin Wolf? Like, you know, I mean, like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah.
You know, it's not like Kevin Adams is going to trade, you know, a high quality player for futures. That's not at all what he's interested in doing. So that's the challenging part. There are literally 20 teams that are interested in Dylan Cousins. That makes so much sense. So now you go from Cousins to, you know, some of the speculation, loose speculation around certain guys. I had an Eastern Conference GM reach out to me this morning asking about Owen Power. And, you know, is there anything to this? Well, no, there isn't anything to it. I mean, no one has called Adams to say, hey, if you ever get to that place where you want to trade Owen, you know, let us know. No. But, you know, Adams can't every single day put out the fires that continue to swirl around the roster of the Buffalo Sabres. He can't, and he has to maintain the position that I'm open to ideas, and not specific only to Kevin. That's what I'm getting from a lot of managers, guys. That's the new phrase for 2025 heading into the deadline, open for ideas, which means, hey, I don't know. I guess I have some untouchables, but if you want to have a conversation, let's have a conversation. And I think you can lump Kevin, you can lump probably a half a dozen or more managers into that category.
For the first time since he was acquired, I have seen Alex Tuch's name out there again saying, oh, he'd be a good fit in Tampa Bay. He'd be a good fit with this team, with that team. Is this the same thing? Like, it's teams wanting to be open for ideas and kind of trying to match players with opportunity, and Alex Tuch would be an error. Is there something to be said that, well, Alex Tuch would be a guy that Kevin Adams may look to get a really good return upon, because he could get a good return with Alex
Tuch.
And you know, he's an excellent example because, sure, I can assure you that Adams isn't shopping Alex Tuch, but Alex Tuch makes a contending team that much better, right? The quality of game that he's capable of playing. The problem with acquiring a piece like that, again, having to overpay here, given he's got a great contract with Buffalo, you know, having to overpay, you almost have to tear apart your roster to acquire a player like that. So I would put Alex Tuch in a category of, who would be another one? Braden Schenn with the St. Louis Blues, right? You know, now Braden Schenn has no trade protection. But St. Louis is, what, 6 points out of a playoff spot? And we're going to continue to talk about that guy until March 7th. And the reason that we're even talking is because, you know, that Doug Armstrong, who's an aggressive GM, would be gathering information. He'd be assessing what the market might look like for the idea of potentially trading his captain. Doesn't want to, but if somebody's willing to stand up and pay a price that you can't turn your back on, well, then you have to consider it. And I think to a degree that Alex Tuch fits into that similar a slot of the player that every contender can envision how, again, that player would make them better. They just don't want to have to give up what they're going to have to give up to get in that game.
Give up is a tough phrase to use when a team is going through a tough stretch. You don't, you know, it's the players are trying, obviously, but not getting results. I'm speaking specifically about Montreal here, who were the darlings of the league for a little bit. Now they've lost 6 of 7. And I'm wondering, do they, quote unquote, give up on this season to move forward down the road? Like, how have you viewed the landscape changing for Montreal potentially here in the last few weeks?
It is tricky, and you've painted the picture well, because Ken Hughes, you know, has to be sensitive to that market and what they've accomplished to this point of the season. And yeah, it's unfortunate that they've gone through this streak of games. The belief is that they will be better, that they will stay in the fight, and you know, whether or not they can lock down a spot, to me, it's too lofty. Every time I've checked in with Montreal, the feedback that I get is very similar. We can't take our eye off what we need to be next year, right? They needed to be competitive this year, and they've proven that they are a competitive team. But then you have to look at, okay, well, what are we talking about? Who are some of the pieces? And, you know, I look at Savard and I look at Matheson. And if you allow yourself to look into that crystal ball and you can envision the team being better next year and better the year after, that's probably without David Savard and Mike Matheson, right? Like, they're going to age out at some point in the not too distant future. So why wouldn't you take advantage of that? You know, that's a big part of why they made the trade with the Nashville Predators when they did, and they brought in Alex Carrier. Mm-hmm. And that was backfill for either Savard or Matheson. So I think they stay the course, and I think they consider and will probably move one or both of those guys. But I doubt that they dig deeper into their roster beyond that.
Dregs, I want to ask you about Ryan Hartman. He got suspended for 10 games. He's going to lose almost $500,000 because he's a repeat offender. So instead of being about 5% of his salary in, you know, fines for the suspension, it's about 12% because it's a different formula. So he's appealing the 10-game suspension. So the process is what? He appeals to Gary Bettman. Mm-hmm. And then if the suspension remains 10 or
goes to a third party,
third party, is he going to get to that, or are we going to see this reduce?
Well, you know, Bettman doesn't expedite this process, never has and never will. And I don't think that that's just solely to defend the decision made by George Parrish and the Department of Player Safety. In this case, he's got 10 games. So he's got time working on his side. You know, what hurts Ryan Hartman, and I think that the Department of Player Safety did a good thing in explaining in the detail that they did the video as to how they got to the 10 games. You know, 663 games played. Ryan Hartman has faced league discipline, fine or suspension, every 60 games played in the National Hockey League. I mean, come on. And then 4 suspensions since 2023. So the rap sheet shows you evidence that this guy isn't getting it. And then you look at the play that earned him the 10-game suspension. That's a tough one to defend. You know, I get as a centerman, you know, your progress pushes you forward. I understand that maybe you lose your balance, but he plants his forearm to the back of Timmy Stützle's head. And then, you know, his body weight drives it into the ice. This one has the feel of, if there had been serious injury here, what are we talking about, man?
Like 25.
15 plus. Yeah. I mean, how do you argue that?
Yeah.
So I'd be surprised if Commissioner Bettman doesn't uphold the 10 games and then go to the third party. Yeah, sure. I mean, that's why the appeal process is there, to defend the player in this case. But again, when you look at history for Ryan Hartman, it's a tough one to overturn for me.
I know we've talked about this name a lot, but he has returned and has helped the Ducks have a bigger impact in their games. They've won 5 of the last 6, but Trevor Zegras' name continues to float out there,
yeah,
despite the offense being up and the results being better since he returned. What's up?
It's a good question. And I, you know, I'm starting to think of Trevor Zegras the way I do John Gibson. You know, in that his name is going to always be out there until something happens, or inevitably it doesn't happen, right? Like,
yeah.
And again, I think the last time we talked a little bit about this, and I brought up Vetrano's name and how when they talked about, you know, the type of extension that he signed, they acknowledged that in the not too distant future, they're going to be a cap team, which is why they needed the deferral option with Frankie Vetrano's extension. So if you see yourself being in that mode, then why are you trying to trade away a dynamic piece? A player who I think is trying his best. He's working hard to be more of a two-way forward than what he is. That's them. Look, defending in the game is never going to be top priority for Trevor Zegras. And in that market, I don't know that it needs to be, but I think that he's got the qualities of a difference-making type of player, and that's the reason why when you get to this point leading up to the trade deadline, the rumors are out there from a media standpoint, which leads to general managers calling Pat Verbeek to say, where are you now? What sort of return do you need? And I think Verbeek at this stage is at least willing to listen.
Are we going to see Quinn Hughes, Sidney Crosby, and others, Mitch Marner, that are dealing with injuries right now, but are part of the Four Nations tournament? Like, are we going to see them actually play in the Four Nations faceoff?
Well, I think you'll see Mitch Marner play. The expectation is he plays tonight in Seattle. The other two big question marks. Mike Sullivan recently, you know, approached the media. Sidney Crosby was briefly on the ice with the main group, and then he did some stuff on the side. So the fact that he's even skating today, I think bodes well. But, you know, they just basically said need more evaluation to make that call on Crosby. And what a blow that would be for hockey fans, right? Like, my excitement level for the Four Nations is limited, but it's mostly there because I want to see what Sidney Crosby, Connor McDavid, and Nathan MacKinnon are capable of on the same team, same sheet ice. So you take that away, oh boy. I think the Quinn Hughes situation is the most intriguing of all. Quinn Hughes would love to be playing with the Vancouver Canucks. That's how I read it. That's how I, like, he I wouldn't say he feels healthy enough, but he's a kid that can gut through. He wants to play so that he can get to the Four Nations and represent USA. And it sure sounds like the Vancouver Canucks are like, nah, you're not healthy enough, man. You're not healthy enough to play. And by extension, Four Nations at this stage looks like a long shot. But, you know, what do they have until Monday? So there's still some time to figure all of this out.
Real quick, do you think the Kings are going to add anything? They've gone through maybe their dip. They've won 2 in a row. They are the best home team in the NHL, and they have a home-heavy schedule the rest of the way. So does this put them in an add mode?
Dabbling add, I would say. You know, I asked Rob Blake about this the other day, and it was more in line with you see Drew Doughty's minutes again last night, 25-plus minutes in that win over the Montreal Canadiens. He feels like a major add. So what Blake told me was, sure, we're always looking for something, but more likely it'll be depth in the areas that you normally want to add depth, and that's up front and on defense.
Dregs, thank you so much. We'll see you again next week.
You bet. Go Eagles.
Darren yes. Dreger, our hockey insider from TSN.
Is this a business play by Myles Garrett? I don't think so. I think he legitimately wants to be in a place where he feels like he's going to have a chance to win the Super Bowl. But again, is there anything that could get him off that that changes his mind? In his ideal world, that's what he's doing. I think the best way of saying it, he wants to go to what he believes is a Super Bowl contender. I think that would be a place that he believes gives him more hope to win a Super Bowl than the Browns do. And there are probably multiple NFL franchises that would fall into that category.
That is ESPN's Adam Schefter. He was on the Pat McAfee Show. His thoughts on Myles Garrett. Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's some sort of contractual play by him, right? Maybe at some point there's a new deal down the road for the new team or even the Browns if they work something out and he stays there. But it doesn't seem like that. This seems like, you know, straight from his words, he wants to go somewhere for the reasons of winning or whatever else. And even seemingly taking a shot at Andrew Berry, the GM of the Browns, and what he said last week when Myles Garrett wrote his statement. To talk about it all right now with us on the Wester Hotline is Daryl Ryder of 92.3 The Fan, our Odyssey sister station in Cleveland. Good morning, buddy. How are you?
Good, guys. How are you?
I'm good. All right, Daryl. Well, let's just start where. How did it get to this point, and how surprised are you or Browns fans that it got to this point?
I'm not the least bit surprised that it got to this point. From my standpoint, a matter of when, not if, Myles Garrett was going to request a trade. Look, Garrett made his displeasure with the organization and the direction of it very well known toward the end of December, there around December 20th, when he, just basically laid it out, frustration with the team losing. And when he said that this was a more disappointing season, finishing 3-14, than when they went 0-16 his rookie year. This was a team that was supposed to not only make the playoffs, but potentially make some noise in the playoffs. And they ended up being the second worst team in the National Football League. So he wants to win. There's nothing really much individually for him to accomplish as a player. He's a defensive player of the year. He's been a first team all pro four times, maybe five. We'll see how the voting goes this year. He has made six Pro Bowls. So the last thing for him to do is to win a Super Bowl. And let's be honest about it. The Cleveland Browns are light years away from doing that. So why would he continue to stay here in Cleveland with a franchise that continues to fail at all levels? And, they don't have a franchise quarterback. There is not a franchise quarterback in the offing, at least not in this draft that we know of. He wants out, and Browns fans, once again, are simply beside themselves.
Daryl Ryder on the Wester Hotline. All right. Well, I mean, is this a point of no return? Do you think that this is something that they will get together on to try and make this work, or are we really to the point of they have to get moving on this because Myles Garrett will never play in a Browns uniform again?
Well, I mean, look, when a player tells you he doesn't want to be there anymore, I think you should believe him. Andrew Berry already made one fatal mistake when a player told him no. That was Deshaun Watson, right? People forget Deshaun originally told the Browns thanks, but no thanks. And then the Browns like, oh, well, here, what if we fully guarantee $230 million? And Deshaun's like, well, yeah, sure, why not? Snow, playing in the snow sounds good to me, right? Could the Browns try and make him the, richest defensive player in NFL history? Absolutely. Is that enough to change Myles Garrett's tune? I don't know. I do feel like that. I think this is more than just a contract ploy. It'd be disingenuous for me to sit here and say that it has nothing to do with this contract, because it does. He at the time when he signed his 5-year, $125 million extension off his rookie deal, that was a record contract. That record stood for all of 3 weeks. And so now at $25 million a year, considering what his resume is, he's underpaid. And I realize that I'm saying $25 million a year for somebody is them being underpaid. But like in the economics in the National Football League, he's underpaid. But let's be honest about it, right? He's got 2 years left on his contract. So this is the perfect time for him to pursue that extension. And I think his point is he wants to get that taken care of now and secure his long-term future once again, while also at the same time being on a team that is competent and has a chance to compete for a Super Bowl, and the Cleveland Browns are neither of those things.
The acquiring team, according to SpotTrack, would only be taking on $13 million of cap space. And then at some point, I'm sure, as you said, there would be, you know, coming together to try and figure out a long-term contract. All right, let's just say, Daryl, that they decide, okay, we have to do this. We're going to move on. Do you see them looking for mostly draft picks, couple number one, something like that? Could it be looking for a quarterback? They are picking number two in the draft. Like, is this an opportunity even for them, the Browns here, to say, you know what, maybe this is a chance for us to grab a quarterback who's already out there? Someone just called up and suggested J.J. McCarthy from the Vikings, Sam Darnold signs. It could be him or anybody else, but could that be the type of opportunity maybe that could present itself?
Hey, you know what? Josh Allen's not been able to get the Bills across the finish line. So, you know, hey, if you want to give us Josh Allen for Myles Garrett, I'm sure the Browns would do that one straight up. But I'm totally kidding with you.
I do think
that the conversation starts at two first-round picks. I think three first-round picks is completely unreasonable, and, like, you're just, like, living in la-la land at that point. But I think it's reasonable to ask for two, you know, first round picks and maybe, a sweetener pick or two in there. Maybe you do some pick swaps in there. The Browns send, you know, some of their a couple of draft picks over for better draft picks, if that makes sense, along with those two, you know, first rounders. I think that that's the Khalil Mack trade a few years ago between the Raiders and the Bears. I think that what the Browns could expect to receive in return. Miles is 29, so it's not like he's in his mid-30s and on the back end of his career here. Those are like, oh, yeah, you should get three number ones for him. Like, you're in la-la land. Like, that's just totally unreasonable. But when you look at the current state of the Browns, their needs, they have four of the top 103 selections in the upcoming draft. So draft picks now, not necessarily a big deal. However, you know, next year where the quarterback class is going to be better, because folks are telling me that, like, this quarterback class just isn't good, right? Yes, Cam Ward is probably going number one, but somebody's reaching for him. Cam Ward would be the sixth, seventh, or eighth player taken in last year's quarterback class. That tells you a lot. So go ahead and let other teams reach, you know, pump up Shador Sanders, get someone, you know, sucker someone in to come up to number two to take Shador, looking at you, Las Vegas Raiders and New York Football Giants. I'm looking at next year's draft class and banking on that being the year that maybe there is a franchise quarterback. And I'm not saying there isn't a franchise quarterback in this draft. I just don't trust Andrew Berry to have the eyeballs to actually recognize what a franchise quarterback actually looks like. So I just rather the next GM next year make that decision. So, build for the future. And if you trade Miles, I think you just got to burn this whole thing down. Trade Denzel Ward, trade Wyatt Teller, trade every good player you have, accumulate as many draft picks as possible. You're trading your best player on your team.
Yeah.
You're not getting Myles Garrett in the draft again, right? That just isn't happening. The Browns have never had a player like Myles Garrett, and they can't win with him. So you might as well hit the reset button for what will be, I think, like the 15th time since 1999. Allow this regime to be lame duck, go through this year, set it up for next year, fire everybody, and, you know, bring in new people to start the next rebuild.
The wheels on the bus go round and round, right? We've been there as well, and I understand completely what you're saying. From a Buffalo perspective, I've just been going through, and, you know, Bills fans, just like every fan base, oh, go get Myles Garrett. Okay, I do think the Bills are the type of team that would make sense at this particular time in their window.
Absolutely.
I've been going through the ages of some of the greatest pass rushers ever, and a lot of them did their best work after the age of 30. From what you've seen, Daryl, of Myles Garrett, is he slowing down? Does he still have a lot left?
No, he's getting better. That's the scary part. And yeah. And I realized, like, fans, they just want to look at box scores, right? They see, okay, he was second in the NFL in sacks this year. He won Defensive Player of the Year last year, and I think he was fifth or sixth in the league in sacks. He gets held on every play. Like, I invite fans to just Google Myles Garrett, click pictures, and look at all the times where he's being held in those photos. He never draws a holding flag. The next holding flag Myles Garrett draws will be the first. I mean, teams tackle him. They double team him, triple team him. They chip him. And he still finds ways to be disruptive. He plays through injury and finds ways to be disruptive. He wasn't all that healthy at the beginning of this past season. But, no, I don't see any signs of this guy slowing down anytime soon. He is he's a freak of nature, and I mean that as a compliment because I just don't know how to, you know, describe him in any other way. I've never seen a football player like him. I think he's got plenty left in the tank for sure.
Daryl, is there a favorite idea for Browns fans in the draft? And of course, that would maybe also be dependent upon what does happen with Myles Garrett. But as it stands right now, is there a favorite idea of what direction they want to go, whether that's position or player?
Well, you know, the fans are lapping up the quarterback overhyping that's going on right now. They're talking mm-hmm. themselves into one of these two guys actually being worth what they're project. You know, the experts are projecting them to be selected. My theory is that the Browns should totally sucker the Giants or the Raiders into coming up and getting Shedeur Sanders with the second pick. Collect another extra first round pick for 2026. You stay in the top eight of the draft. I think top six, I'm sorry, Vegas is six. You stay in the top six in the draft by doing that as well. If you trade Myles Garrett, hey, you got three first round picks next year in the same draft that you can trade for the number one pick. Plus, hey, if you want to get nuts, and hey, these are the Browns, they tend to get nuts, hey, we'll give you our 2027 first-round pick, too. So that'd be four first-round picks that they could offer. And again, this is like just me spitballing, throwing crazy ideas against the wall, but hey, it can't be any worse than what this front office does. So I think trading down a couple of spots and then taking best player on the board, the Browns have a lot of needs. They're not just a quarterback away. If they were just a quarterback away, the team would have gotten better after Deshaun Watson blew out his Achilles, and they didn't. They need this is a great draft for running backs. They need to replace Nick Chubb. This is a pretty good draft for trench players, offensive, defensive linemen. They got questions on both sides of that ball. JOK, we don't know what his future is. Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah, their sideline-to-sideline defending linebacker, suffered that real bad neck injury. Last season, we don't know what his future entails. They might need a sideline-to-sideline defending linebacker in this draft. You always need secondary help. It's a passing league. So there's a lot of holes the Browns still need to fill on this roster that's not a quarterback, and I do feel like this is the draft to do that, and it's imperative on this front office to hit on some of those picks so that if they are positioned in 2026 to draft a quarterback or at least acquire the pick that's going to be required to draft that quarterback, they're able to do it.
A couple more minutes here with Daryl Ryder, 92.3, the Fan of Cleveland. One more, Myles Garrett. I don't know if you know the answer to this. My apologies for putting you on the spot, but I've had people say to me, doesn't Myles Garrett have a no-trade clause? Now, he literally asked for a trade, but if he did have one, he could veto a trade to any team. I haven't heard anything like that. Have you heard that he has one or not?
I am not aware of a no-trade clause. So,
okay.
It would stand to reason that if he asks for a trade, he either doesn't have a no-trade clause or he is waiving the no-trade clause, right?
That's exactly right. That's what I said. I mean, yeah, they could basically ship him, you know, kind of wherever they want to ship him. So we'll see how that plays out. All right. How cool is it, though, for Cleveland fans to be experiencing this Cavaliers season right now for you guys, man?
I mean, they're a lot of fun. Big game tonight. Boston Celtics come to town. Cavs have already beaten the Celtics once this year. It is a unique team. There's no egos. They're a lot of fun to cover. And what makes me believe that they're staying power with this team, it reminds me a little bit of the Golden State Warriors before they took off in the middle of last decade. All the guys have been paid. So you're not going to have guys jockeying for their next contracts. Donovan Mitchell committed. You know, Evan Mobley was just extended. Darius Garland is on a max deal. And Jared Allen was extended this offseason as well. So the core four players, and even the core pieces of the supporting cast, guys like Caris LeVert, who I know people want to try and like throw him in the trade machine because the Cavs need to make a trade just to show that they're all in or whatever. Like, I think they're all in as it is. And they're NBA championship contenders as is. But yeah, I mean, and there's no egos. They play like a team. You know, when guys have charity events off the floor, teammates show up to that. The team's G League affiliate, the Charge, play in downtown Cleveland, and guys show up to those games. Like, they have nothing else better to do in Cleveland but go to a Cleveland Charge game. Okay, cool, right? It's a very unique culture that they've built, and that's why I'm so optimistic about their prospects, because they just have such a good culture. It's like the polar opposite of what the Cleveland Browns have.
I know. It's amazing. The number one team in the league as far as winning percentage, 40-9. Cavaliers having a great year. Daryl, before you go, every time you come on, I think once or twice a year we have you on, and I always ask you about what's going on with the stadium. And I know you could probably talk an hour about this, and maybe we can do that at some point, have a much longer discussion because we went through it here. But what is the latest basic update on the Brown Stadium situation?
Well, the governor of the state of Ohio just proposed yesterday an increase in the sports gaming tax, which is 20% now. It would double. The extra 20% would generate $130 to $180 million a year in revenue. The governor wants that fund to be used for stadium construction projects statewide. The Browns aren't the only team. Cincinnati Bengals want to do a $1.2 billion renovation of their stadium. You know, the Cincinnati Reds ballpark is going to need some work here soon. Columbus Blue Jackets Arena going to need some work. So he wants to, instead of just, you know, like what the Guardians and the Cavs did a couple of years ago where they went to the state asking for X dollars, the governor's trying to create a fund to be able to handle state contributions. Meanwhile, the Browns and the city of Cleveland are suing each other in court. We're waiting to see how that all plays out. The Browns have acquired the land to build the new dome next to the airport. And, you know, so the political theater has to play out. The courtroom stuff has to play out. And the Browns have to get the financing for the stadium in place before they can break ground.
Daryl Ryder, 92.3, The Fan in Cleveland. All right, well, as always, it's going to be a very interesting and fun offseason in Cleveland and around the rest of the NFL. I'm sure we'll catch up. Maybe we'll see each other in Indy at the Combine or along the way, buddy. Thanks a lot for doing this morning.
Look forward to it, Sal. Thank you.
All right, you got it. Daryl Ryder right there does an excellent job in Cleveland. He's really good at his job. Love talking with him. I'll see him in Cleveland and Indy, I'm sure, at the Scouting Combine.
It's Paul Hamilton.
Oh, Cervantes and Hamilton going to each other and Sawinski. Fights into it.
We have a fight.
With Mike Shope and the Bulldog.
Knocheck was just totaled by an Iowa State player against the board.
I think it was by Hamilton.
On WGR.
Really a pretty unnecessary hit by Hamilton. Hamilton is still awfully mad. He's being held back.
Number 17, Paul Hamilton. 2 minutes for charging, 5 minutes for fighting, and a misconduct.
Sports Radio 550.
This is why you love us. Well, this is why I love us. We're talking about kneel downs. It's that kind of show. How often does it happen? Just random thing. How often does a half in the NFL end on a kneel down? I threw out a number, 20%. You think it's higher than that? Bulldog's like, yes. How about 50%? Is it closer to 50%? What did you say?
40. I said 40. Closer to 50. Sure, 40 is closer to 50 than 20, so I said 40. Yeah.
I just went through every game this year. 20 games.
Just the Bills games.
Just
not the whole league. The commercial breaks aren't that long.
No. They seem like it, but they're not. Right. 20 games. 40 halves. 20 times.
All right.
That's why I love us. 20 out of 40. Exactly. Paul, isn't that 50%? 20 out of 40, that's 50%. Half the halves this year in Bills games.
I'm not sure how they're teaching math these days in schools, but I think that's still half.
I don't know how. There's a certain way you're supposed to be able to show your work. That is, I'm lost. Well,
Brian Koziel is a math teacher, and I always defer to him. So, Brian's my mathematician.
Mitchell Trubisky kneeled out games 7 times this year. That's a good season.
That is a good season. Yes, it is.
Including the Denver game in the playoffs. There were a few games where it happened in each half, including the last two. The Ravens and the Chiefs games had kneel downs on the end of each half. And one more, the Houston game did not have a kneel down at the end of either half. It had a Houston field goal at the end of each half, last play. So there you go. Paul, just what you wanted to know. Or you already did know.
Aren't you glad you carved out this time for us, Paul? Thanks for being with us, Paul.
Paul's appearance. Great to be with you guys.
Brought to you by Paul. I'm wondering this. This came to my attention today. I read Elliot Friedman had a little bit of a blurb about, you know, what he's heard about what went on in the locker room meeting and the threat of the leadership core being stripped of A's or something. Did you notice guys not? Were there any assistant or alternate? Alternate captains on Tuesday night? Someone sent me the
there were not
the lineup. Okay, and Darlene had the little. I think there's usually that's represented on that lineup sheet that you get at every game. Darlene had the little C with, you know, in parentheses next to his name, and there were no A's there. Was that just the rotation because Thompson and Samuelson didn't play, or was that
What happens is Granato did this too. Coaches before Granato, if there was an A not dressed, they would put the A on somebody else.
Right.
And Granato never did. And now Lindy never did. He was asked about it and said, no, it's just they weren't dressed and we didn't put an A on somebody. He said it was no big deal. But he hasn't at other times either. And quite honestly, I haven't even picked up the rotation. I knew that there were like two guys that wore them at home and two guys that wore them on the road.
Right, okay.
And then they were going to switch it after halfway through the season. And it was like, people have A's on their sweater. I didn't. Wasn't that important to me that I cared who wore it at home and who wore it on the road type of a thing.
Same here, yeah.
And they could have, you know, if two guys weren't dressed, you could have put the A's on the other guys who don't normally wear the A's at home, and it's like, whatever.
Right. So doesn't have to necessarily correlate to some sort of punishment because of what happened on Sunday, that they didn't have A's, because it's happened, like you're saying, it's happened before.
Yes.
And maybe it makes sense. Thompson and Samuelson are the home A's. Is it Cousins and Tuck are the road A's? I know Tuck is one of them. I don't know about Cousins, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. So, all right. So... yeah, I don't know, man. Like, how shook up do you think they really were about the whole thing?
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, what Elliot wrote, Elliot got it, second or third hand? My experience is, the players were embarrassed enough that they were called out. People know, everybody who's a fan knows who was on the ice. And it was an utter embarrassment to the players that were on the ice who did not respond. They're not going to, in the middle of a season, take an A or a C off somebody.
Right.
And embarrass them even more. As far as that goes, I'm just not buying that one. And as I said, Elliot did, and he said so, that,
yeah,
it was a player who talked to another player, and we're talking about second, third hand here. So I'm honestly not really buying it. I think there was enough embarrassment to go around just by not responding.
A player on another team who has a friend on Buffalo is how he worded it.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm just imagining a scenario where, Kevin Adams is in there yelling at them, and they're sitting at their locker stalls like, oh my God, get me out of here.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to be like, you know, truancy needs to be punished, right? If these guys are being insubordinate, that'd be one. I just imagine them all sitting there like going, what are we doing? I mean, not to say it wasn't a serious thing. Like, it was embarrassing what happened, but I don't know, man. The meeting and any kind of a threat it's just another piece of a dysfunctional looking puzzle, I think.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's just, you know, I'm sure nobody would confirm it, but I would almost guarantee Kevin Adams was in there melting the paint off the wall. I mean, I was around after the Lucic thing, Buffalo went straight to Montreal for practice, and I was a pretty good ways down the hall from the Sabre locker room, and Darcy Regier was going absolutely out of his mind. He was screaming at the top of his lungs at those guys. So I have no doubt in my mind, even though I have no confirmation or nobody's told me anything, that Kevin Adams is right in the middle of all that, and I'm sure he was not happy.
Yeah, the embarrassment or, you know, sort of the stain of it does move throughout the organization. You know, if you're coaching the team, how could you coach a team that doesn't do that? If you've built the roster, how could you build a roster that doesn't account for that? Absolutely. So sort of everybody can, you know, is accountable for it. The Sabres, however, repaired the situation entirely by having a fight 3 seconds into the game on Tuesday against Columbus, and I feel like now all is good.
I this is absolutely nothing on Dennis Gilbert.
Right.
I have never doubted at any point that Dennis Gilbert is a good teammate. He will always stick up for a teammate, has already done it. I have no doubts in my mind about Dennis Gilbert at all. So it's just, you know, as a matter of fact, I even would talk about the good plays he made in that game. He had a great assist.
Yeah, great play on the second tuck goal.
He had a couple of very key block shots. Yeah. I'd rather more talk about that. I'm just not a fan of staged fights. And you know, I don't mind a hockey fight.
Sure.
I'm all for it.
Lindy even said after the game he would have preferred it be a meaningful fight. Yeah. And I think doubled down on that the next day when he was on with Jeremy and Joe here on the station. Like similar. Yeah, I think it's a situation for me where two things can be true. Like, I admire Gilbert for taking that on. You and I talked in the afternoon before the game, and I'm like, I hope nobody tries to do that because that could be bad, because that guy's a killer. He's one of the toughest guys in the league.
He is.
So I admire him, but I still think, I don't know, like, the players are what matter, I guess, more than how we feel out here. But I just felt like it reminded me, and I felt stupid. I told this to Mike off the air earlier, or I think maybe even we started the show with it. I felt stupid for not remembering Dalton Smith. I don't remember the scenario for why he was called up, but something like this happened in a game. The Sabres didn't respond appropriately, and they called Dalton Smith up. He came up, played a minute 20, took a 2-minute penalty, and never played again.
Right.
And I felt like I should have been aware of that and expecting something like that on Tuesday night. It just doesn't. I don't know, man. It just doesn't do anything about what happened. What happened was in a moment, and you collectively turtled and ignored a situation that needed addressing in the moment. And so good on Gilbert for fighting a tough guy, but I don't know. It doesn't really change a damn thing in my view.
And I guarantee you, if Dennis Gilbert was on the ice when Thompson got hit, that whole thing would have been different. I guarantee it. And one thing I will tell you, too, there isn't one player in that locker room who doesn't respect Dennis Gilbert. I can tell you that. Even though Dennis only plays, you know, 5-6 minutes in a game, they respect Dennis Gilbert. They think he's a good teammate, and they know he will be there. I mean, he took on Brady Tkachuk a couple of times when Brady Tkachuk thought that he could just take any liberty he wanted with the Sabres. He did it in Buffalo, and he did it in Ottawa. And Brady Tkachuk is no easy pushover either. So I can tell you, unequivocally, there is nobody on that roster who doesn't respect Dennis Gilbert and what he does for this team.
Paul Hamilton on the Wester Hotline. By the way, 4 wins in a row, which is kind of record stuff here lately, more than 2 years. Nashville isn't that good. Sabres have just beaten them recently, and that's the road game on Saturday, then 2 weeks. Is it crazy to think they could win this game and come back from the break? The break doesn't help or hurt me for this idea necessarily, and keep going.
Sure, they could keep going. I mean, a lot of the pressure is off right now, you know, from where you are, and I've seen this before where all of a sudden they get going at the end of a year when the pressure is off. But I don't want to belittle what they're doing.
Right.
In my opinion, they have played 7 pretty good games right in a row here. And the 2 they lost, they easily could have won. They were tied in both you know, going into the third. And, you know, I people are going to get sick of me bringing this up, but I keep bringing it up. And the two losses, they had 151 shot attempts. You should win both hockey games when you have 151 shot attempts and only score four goals. They had golden opportunities that they messed up, but I thought overall they played well. They just didn't convert their opportunities in the two losses. So they're 5-2 ever since that Seattle game where they did score four goals but still lost the game and I don't think played well. You know, I think they've each game since then they've played well. So, yeah, Mike, I think absolutely they could – you know, win that game in Nashville and then pick it up because the schedule coming out isn't, like, extremely hard. There are a couple of hard games in there. Carolina, if I'm not mistaken, is in there somewhere. You know, the Rangers are up and down. You don't know what you're going to get with the Rangers. And they did beat Carolina, but now this time they're going to have to go into Carolina, so that's going to be a tough task. But still, coming out, I could see them still playing well. And that's, you know, somebody said to me, and I – totally respect the point that, well, what does winning right now do for them? I mean, and it's not necessarily winning. I think what they need to be doing right now is figuring out how to play well almost every night instead of every eighth game or two periods and then not doing it for three or four games or whatever. Because I believe that if you play the way Lindy Ruff has asked you to play, the results will take care of themselves. And I think we're seeing that in the last seven games. They've been basically playing the way Lindy Ruff wants them to, and they got five wins and two losses, which isn't a bad record. So that's what I think is important right now, is getting some consistency in the way you play the game and the pride you play the game with and you know, moving forward with it. Do I think they have a chance at the playoffs? Well, if this winning streak, and I'm being serious here, gets to be about 10 to 15 in a row, yeah, they got a chance at the playoffs. Short of that, no, I don't think they do.
Yeah. I didn't see any evidence of practice today, so I'm imagining today was a day off.
It was.
Okay.
Yes.
So we won't know anything. I imagine they're flying tomorrow, right, after practice to Nashville. So that'll be our clue about Thompson. You know, Samuelson's on IR. And I guess Ukko Pekka Luukkonen, too. We can be and isn't Cousins injured now,
Cousins
too?
Cousins was – Lindy didn't really know. It was like he had a lower body complication, as he called it. And he said, we're going to have to see. He didn't really know what to say about it after practice the other day. It sounds like Luukkonen is going to be on the ice for practice tomorrow, the way Lindy was talking. And the way he talked about Greenway, he said the medical staff has put a certain timeline on him, which is the first game after the break. And they did that on purpose. He goes, if we were in a playoff series and he absolutely had to play, he'd probably be playing on Saturday. But he said, I'm going to trust the medical staff, and so it doesn't sound like Greenway is going to get a shot on Saturday, and he will be back when the break is over. But Cousins, he just really didn't know about. It was kind of a new thing, and he just didn't know what to say about it. I don't want to degrade it. Thompson has to pass protocols. He skated on his own and apparently felt very good. Lindy said that he felt extremely good, actually, but he said he still has to pass the protocols and has time to do it. He had yesterday, today, tomorrow, until you get to the game on Saturday. So he could very well be at practice tomorrow if he has passed protocols, but it didn't seem like he was having any lingering effects. And he was sitting on the bench laughing and talking, you know, during practice, so he was around. So it seems like it's possible we could see him practice and maybe even play on Saturday.
Did Ruff misspeak on Sunday after the game when he said Thompson, whatever the words were, like passed and was fine?
No, because I can attest to this. Unfortunately, I have had three major concussions, and it doesn't necessarily happen right away. Mine actually happened more than a few days down the road. Our old sports director, Bob Gaughan, was like all of a sudden, like 3 or 4 days later, and I'm sitting there reading a story, and I read it three times in a row, and I argued with him. I said, no, I didn't. And he got the tape out, and he goes, yeah, you did.
Wow.
And it was 3 days later. So, unfortunately, I do have some experience at this. So you can feel great to start with, and then all of a sudden it can start coming on.
All right, Paul, any questions for us?
I did not prepare for questions. No, you haven't asked me that in a while, so I haven't been prepared for that.
Wonder why. Who wins the NFL MVP tonight?
I guess I have to I believe it will be Lamar.
Okay.
I'm of the opinion that I think Lamar has been the best player in the NFL, and I think Josh Allen has been the most valuable to his team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's two different awards. You know, the Lamar won the AP award or whatever, yeah, I think that's right. But if you're talking about the MVP, I think you're talking about the man most valuable to his team, and I think that would be Allen. And so I think you both could be winning awards for different reasons.
Yep, I think we could see that tonight too. Mm-hmm. Very good. Thanks, Paul.
Okay.
There you go. That's our Paul Hamilton on the Western Hotline. His appearance is here on WGR, brought to you by Equitable Advisors. Planning for your future is about more than just money. Let Equitable be your guide, and by Relax Honda. Relax, we got this.